Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, everybody. I'm David Green, and we want to begin with the situation in Gaza, which is growing even more dire for Palestinian civilians there. A UN-backed report says that famine is imminent, and the Gaza Health Ministry says people are already dying of hunger. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says that he is still planning a ground offensive in the southern Gaza city of Rafah. He says it is essential to eliminate Hamas and the group's military capabilities. Christopher Lockyer is Secretary General of the organization Doctors Without Borders. He is in Rafah, and he spoke to NPR about the potential for an Israeli offensive.
It's terrifying. I'm trying to get my head around it. A ground offensive in this area where I am now would be absolutely horrific. I mean, and where do people go? I mean, just 2 days ago, there was fighting around the Shifa hospital in the north, and people were told to evacuate there to the Al-Muazi area of Rafah, which is literally exactly where I'm sitting now. They couldn't move because of Israeli military checkpoints on the way.
Now, Lockyer is not alone. President Biden has urged Netanyahu not to order this ground attack, which led Israel's prime minister to confess that he is having an argument with the Americans right now. And this is not familiar territory. U.S. presidents and lawmakers are usually unified and unwavering in support of Israel, and that is not the case right now. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, the highest-ranking Jewish politician in American history, openly criticized Netanyahu's leadership in a recent speech.
He won't disavow Ministers Smotrich and Ben-Gvir in their calls for Israelis to drive Palestinians out of Gaza and the West Bank. He won't commit to a military operation in Rafah that prioritizes protecting civilian life. He won't engage responsibly in discussions about a day-after plan for Gaza and a longer-term pathway to peace. Hamas and the Palestinians who support and tolerate their evil ways, radical right-wing Israelis in government and society, President Abbas, Prime Minister Netanyahu. These are the four obstacles to peace.
Schumer did reiterate his support of Israel, but called for an early election to remove Netanyahu. And this speech was a shocking turn for Schumer, who's one of Israel's staunchest congressional supporters. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called out Schumer, saying that he is essentially interfering in Israeli democracy.
Make no mistake, the Democratic Party doesn't have an anti-Bibi problem. It has an anti-Israel problem. Israel is not a colony of America whose leaders serve at the pleasure of the party in power in Washington. Only Israel's citizens should have a say in who runs their government. This is the very definition of democracy and sovereignty.
Now, we should say President Biden praised Senator Schumer for a, quote, good speech and said his statements echoed serious concerns shared not only by him, but by many Americans. So that's where we are as we bring in our regular left, right and center crew. Moa Lathy, executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. He was communications director for the Democratic National Committee and an advisor to Hillary Clinton. And Sarah Isger is here. She's senior editor at The Dispatch, a lawyer who was spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. Mo, I want to start with you, with President Biden and Senator Schumer. This feels like new territory for such high-ranking people in the U.S. government to be really calling on the leader of Israel to change course at such a fragile, tense, and violent moment in that region. I just wonder, has this change in message from people like Schumer and Biden, is this a change of heart in terms of the best foreign policy going forward, or is there really some domestic politics at play here? Because we know a lot of people on the left have been very critical of this White House and Democrats for what they view as allowing Israel to carry out a campaign that has killed so many civilians in Gaza.
I don't know if I would say this is a watershed moment in terms of policy. I think it is very much a watershed moment in terms of politics, though, when it comes to the relationship between the U.S. and Netanyahu. We've been moving in this direction, though, for a little while, right? Where both the U.S. government and the Israeli government, under Benjamin Netanyahu specifically, have become increasingly involved in the domestic politics of the other. You know, when President Obama had very legitimate disagreements and Prime Minister Netanyahu had very legitimate disagreements with us, particularly around the Iran deal, you saw Netanyahu get very engaged in U.S. politics, coming in and doing a joint address to Congress at the invitation of the Republican speaker just weeks before the U.S. election with a message that was not very hidden. In his last election campaign, Netanyahu was running full-size billboards of himself with Donald Trump that Donald Trump was then retweeting.
Right.
These were paid for by his campaign, and the sitting president of the United States then, Donald Trump, was retweeting it. So we've been like moving in a direction where they've been getting more and more engaged.
Well, and Netanyahu just did this meeting with the Senate Republicans. I mean, he's doing the same sort of thing right now.
That's exactly right. I don't like it when Netanyahu gets involved in our politics, and I don't like it when a domestic U.S. politician takes a campaign stand in Israel. Having said that, everything up until calling for a new election, I can't disagree with Chuck Schumer about how the current policies of the current Israeli government are one of several impediments to peace. If he had stopped there, I think it would have been a very different conversation. Taking that last step, I think, is what raised the stakes politically. But everything else, I'm not going to say he's wrong.
I see that. I mean, there was something, there's a distinction between having a debate as tense as it can get over what the best policy is and then going a step further and sending a strong message about political decisions, such as there should be a new election and Netanyahu should be removed. I understand the sentiment, I guess, but that's a big step to make. Sarah, do you agree with that distinction? I mean, we're talking about sort of debate over policy and then getting involved in another country's domestic politics in both directions.
Yeah, I think I don't disagree with Mo at all, which feels very uncomfortable for me. I don't know what I think about this. Yeah, just to reemphasize, I guess, there's no problem with saying that Netanyahu is an impediment to peace. Look, Israelis, every poll in Israel, except for one, shows Netanyahu massively underwater with Israelis. And the one poll that doesn't show him underwater was done by Netanyahu, right? So, like, he's very deeply unpopular in his own country. I think it was a big mistake on his part, Netanyahu's part, to get involved, to pick teams in American politics. Like, the teams weren't going to switch in terms of who was in power. And what an awful guess, right? To have the team that you didn't pick be in power when the worst terrorist attack to happen in your country occurs. So it was a bad bet. And it was a mistake to make the bet in the first place. So yes to all of the above. I think for those listening who maybe aren't offended by what Chuck Schumer said, you know, let's play the game that we need to play in all of these situations, which is the what if Trump did it game, right? If Donald Trump or one of his cabinet officials, and let's be clear, Chuck Schumer absolutely gave the White House a heads up before he gave this speech. They knew exactly what he was going to say. He did it with the White House's blessing. Mm-hmm. So in my scenario, right, Donald Trump or one of his cabinet officials goes out and says, you know, this crisis at the southern border is being precipitated by Mexico refusing to agree to the Remain in Mexico policy that we need to be able to send people back over the border or refuse to let them in the first place. Therefore, I call for a new election in Mexico to replace the leader of that country until we find someone who will help us fix this problem. And I think we would say that that was outrageous. The idea that you're not getting what you want policy-wise that would help your domestic political problem, so you call for a country to replace its leader for your own domestic political benefit. We would be outraged if Donald Trump did something like that. We would dedicate infinite podcasts to it. And I think we should think of it the same way when Chuck Schumer did it.
Why is calling out what you see as a double standard important? If there is a double standard there, what is the risk? What is the impact of the existence of a double standard like that?
I think part of the reason that we talked about credibility last time with reporters, with the media, and with the left, I would argue. And but the right has its own problems. This is not to excuse any of that. But it comes from that sense of a double standard. And for instance, Mo just said he disagreed with what Chuck Schumer said. So it's not that the left always agrees with it somehow when the left does it or something like that. It's the tone. It's the volume. You know, when Donald Trump called for National Guard to help in the, you know, riots of 2020, that was considered a threat to democracy. But when Kathy Hochul, the governor of New York, sends National Guard troops into the New York subway system to deal with crime, again, there's people on the left who disagree with that, who've pushed back on it. But boy, the volume sounds different. If one is a threat to democracy, so is the other, or neither are. And I don't feel like we're able to decide that, because if Donald Trump does it, we go to an 11.
Mo, you still agreeing with Sarah here?
I mean, I guess, and I don't know that we need to rehash the whole conversation that we had from last week. Yes, I think there should be outrage, no matter who does it, when it comes to interfering or putting your thumb on the scale explicitly in another democracy's elections. Donald Trump danced right up to the line a number of times in a number of European countries, and there was a lot of attention paid to that. I guess I would say it's not like I think Schumer's statements went under the radar, right? It did get a lot of attention, and it raised a lot of eyebrows from folks who I think legitimately recognized it as farther than we typically go. But I don't want to lose sight of the rest of the argument there, which is his underlying assessment. He could have made that exact same underlying assessment, and it would have been totally legitimate. It is totally legitimate for him to do so, that the policies of this government in Israel is making it harder to get to peace, that he is an impediment to peace, not the only one. And I do not want anyone listening to this to think I am letting anyone else off the hook. The single greatest impediment to peace is Hamas. But the way this is playing out and has been playing out in recent months is going to make it very, very difficult to get to peace, even if they were to eradicate Hamas. And so I don't want to lose sight of the fact that that in and of itself is a remarkable place for us to be, and I think a right place for us to be. And he gave the president a little bit of breathing room by having the highest ranking Jewish Democrat in the country, who has been a huge ally to Israel throughout his entire career, gave the president a little bit of breathing room, but it was the right place to be, the right argument to make. I think he stepped on his own argument by taking that final step, which he didn't need to do.
Well, can I ask you about that final step? I mean, let me play devil's advocate here. I tend to agree with both of you that that was a big step and a dangerous one. But if Schumer is sitting there believing we don't interfere in the elections or the political process in another democracy, but he believes right now that the Israeli people, were they to vote tomorrow, would vote out Netanyahu, is there an argument for saying, like, let me celebrate democracy in Israel by saying that the people should have a right to vote in a new election right now?
So I think if he had said, what I'm seeing is that the people of Israel don't support Netanyahu, I have no problem with that, right? He can be descriptive, but we're missing one part of what he said, actually. He didn't just call for new elections in Israel. He did. But he also said something to the effect of, and if they don't, we will have to reconsider aid and our support. And he was tying the two together. And again, look at Donald Trump's first impeachment. Is it identical? No. Am I going to sit here and like do point-by-point comparison? No. But it was the same idea of tying aid to a foreign country based on one's, you know, domestic political situation. And there's no question that Schumer would not have given this speech but for the uncommitted vote in Michigan and going on in these Democratic primaries and the problem that the president is having with Democratic base voters over this issue. Chuck Schumer doesn't give this speech otherwise. And so again, it's not just calling for elections in a foreign country that you have no business doing. It's tying American aid unless they do, which is really like impeachable, crazy stuff.
We got to move on. Mo, do you want to respond to Sarah suggesting that this is tied to sort of the uncommitted vote and Democrats who are abandoning Biden because of what's happening in Gaza?
I'm glad you gave the caveat that it was not a point-by-point comparison, because I don't see that much of a comparison between the President Trump in Ukraine and this situation. I think they are very, very, very different. Secondly, you know, I see why some people would look at this and say Schumer would not have given that speech were it not for the uncommitted vote in Michigan, unless it is what Chuck Schumer and a lot of Democrats actually believe right now. Right. It does. This does not have, we don't have to be so cynical as to say that statement was tied entirely to Democratic primary performance. I think that there is just increasingly people who care about Israel, people who care about the region, people who care about peace are looking at the situation there and saying something's got to change on both sides of the ledger. And the fact that he was willing to go out there, put his own long record of support for Israel on the line makes me think maybe this was more than just about pure base politics.
All right. Mo and Sarah and I will be right back. We're going to talk about TikTok, social media, and a lot of questions about where federal officials should draw the line in terms of placing restrictions on social media and lots of other stuff here on Left, Right, and Center. We're back again with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. Sarah Isger is here. Mo Alathy is here. You know, Sarah, I brought up Saturday Night Live on the show last week and how SNL made fun of Republican Senator Katie Britt for her response to the State of the Union. You said to me that you feel like Republicans often take the brunt of satire, that Democrats are often spared. And so I bring you this gift.
This is not an attempt to ban TikTok. It's an attempt to make TikTok better. Tic-tac-toe. A winner. A winner.
That was California Democrat Nancy Pelosi, the former House Speaker, trying to be funny. And Sarah, everyone pounced. John Oliver was my favorite. He said Pelosi marched to the floor and alienated every American under the age of 35. Fair?
Fair. I loved it. I mean, yes, great. And to be clear, it's that my overall thing on this is that, you know, when we have these roasts and everything else, Republicans are self-deprecating against Republicans and Democrats deprecate Republicans. And so when we look at things like Saturday Night Live, they do have both sides on, but for the Republican caricatures and characters, they're hitting themselves. And then when it's a Democrat on, they're somehow also hitting Republicans. Well, that's my satire.
I think
right
we
now.
Should, yes, we should do an entire segment about this before this election is over. It'll be nice comic relief and also some substance. But in addition to trying to prove you wrong, I actually was bringing up Pelosi and TikTok for a more serious reason, because we've been talking on the show about this election and what's at stake, and maybe if Donald Trump wins, given his stated transparent plans, we could see a slide towards more authoritarian power. But there are actually concrete examples of people already in power taking actions that critics say were stifling free speech for their own political benefit, you know, potentially overstepping the guardrails of democracy already, even as we're having this theoretical conversation. And so I want to start with a Supreme Court case that dates back to just after the 2020 presidential election. The justices are considering whether the Biden administration violated free speech when officials pressured social media platforms to remove posts that, according to the Biden team, were spreading lies about the pandemic and the 2020 presidential election. So, Sarah, I'll start with you. What do you see at stake in this case?
It's fascinating because there were actually two cases argued that day, the one that you just mentioned, and then another one where the New York state official in charge of overseeing insurance and bank regulations sent a letter out, a guidance letter, saying you should really take into consideration the fact that the NRA is bad for your reputation and any gun-promoting organization, and that if you continue to do business with them, we're going to look very carefully at you And we think that you're creating reputational harm, which is actually a, you know, financial thing that they have to consider. And then she met privately with, for instance, Lloyd's and said, we've found all of these sort of ticky-tack things that you've been doing that violate New York state law. But if you agree to cut all ties with the NRA and other gun organizations, we'll look past some of those. And it worked. And so that's a different Supreme Court case where in both of these, we're trying to find the line between the government using its powers to persuade, whether it's social media companies or private organizations, to take their view of the world and where the line is for coercion. And, you know, when it comes to the First Amendment, this is equal opportunity authoritarianism. You've got these two cases. You've got the law that I've mentioned before out of California, where Governor Newsom said that doctors weren't allowed to talk about COVID in a way that wasn't with the scientific consensus that I guess he would define. That law was enjoined. You have the don't say gay law in Florida. You have the book law in Texas. So you have a lot of government officials saying, here's my view of the world, and I'm going to make everyone else have my view of the world, which is pretty much the opposite of the purpose of the First Amendment. I think that the Supreme Court is going to try to draw that coercion persuasion line and give us sort of factors of when it's one versus the other. In the Biden case, they were, you know, really harassing, I don't know what you want to use the right term, just repeatedly going after social media companies in private over email, phone calls, meetings, and saying, take down this misinformation. Here's examples of it. Here's accounts we don't like. And some of it, you know, probably I think we'd all agree was misinformation. But some of it are things that now we probably would say aren't misinformation, like that the COVID virus was created in a lab in China. Well, again, we don't have evidence that it was, but it's certainly not the case that it's misinformation that the government gets to say you don't even get to think that publicly, for instance. They mentioned like, well, gosh, if you're not able to take down this misinformation, we'll have to rethink our position on Section 230, a protection that the social media companies have. There was cursing, which the justices got a big kick out of. You know, is that coercion or is that persuasion? What's the difference between the bully pulpit and just bullying?
Yeah, the China lab case is so interesting because I remember that period where it struck me as this is just an absolute conspiracy theory and that it's, you know, it's an important question whether the government should stop conspiracy theories running rampant, especially during a deadly pandemic that is killing millions and millions of people. And these are hard decisions that government officials make in the moment. But I tend to agree with you. Like, if there's any question, if there's any wiggle room, err on the side of free speech and not limiting speech on social media. And it feels like we're in this moment where the Supreme Court is trying really hard to work this out.
It's another who gets to decide moment, right? Yeah. Who gets to decide what's misinformation? Because if the government, quote unquote, gets to decide that, you're not going to like the result. And I think you see that in the New York case where, you know, Governor Cuomo, who was governor of New York at the time, and this state official basically got together and said publicly, our goal is to bankrupt organizations that promote gun rights and are against the gun regulations that we want. And we're going to use every tool we have, including going after these third parties that provide them insurance or banking, et cetera. And it was incredibly effective. You don't want the government to be able to stifle your speech simply by using their enforcement tools against third parties to do what they could not do themselves against you.
Mo?
That case in New York is one where I agree with you that they should not be using that kind of leverage. As sympathetic I am to the cause, as anti-NRA as I am to the cause.
You don't think state officials in New York should be threatening insurers saying don't do business with the NRA
based on their political viewpoint?
Based on their political viewpoint. I see far more of this happening, and I'm glad Sarah brought up a few of the examples. I see far more of this happening on the right than I do on the left with Don't Say Gay, with some states making it illegal for doctors to talk to women about abortion as an option. You see in a number of communities making it illegal to post a pride flag, a rainbow flag in public spaces. All of those things I think that is happening with far more frequency on issues like that. As to like this particular case, I find it so I laughed. Sarah, you can remind me. One of the conservative justices was incredulous in his question, saying, can you imagine if the New York Times or a regular media outlet faced this kind of pressure from a government official? I can't remember which justice said it. But I read that and I was like, oh, that is so adorable. That is so cute that you think that. Because that push and pull between government and the media, politics and the media, is not just normal. It is part of how our system has always worked. When I was working in political communications, when Sarah was working in political communications, when David was covering political campaigns, we had these types of conversations every day where I would talk to a reporter and sometimes nudge, sometimes push, sometimes scream because they weren't seeing something that was so clear to me. I had reporters push and nudge and scream right back at me. I think that whole back and forth between the media, these which are communications platforms, and the political class is normal and it is natural. Where the line needs to be, as Sarah put it, right, and what the Supreme Court seems to be telling us, it's about to clarify, the line needs to be at coercion. And I leave with one final example of coercion. In 2017 and 2018, then President Donald Trump threatened to revoke the license of NBC News because he did not like their media coverage. Now, never mind that the President of the United States has absolutely no authority to pull the FCC license of a major network, but that to me was an attempt at coercion. And I think the Supreme Court will provide some clarity on where that line actually is.
All right, you're listening to Left, Right, and Center from KCRW. We're talking about, the Supreme Court looking at several cases that could draw the line on when government officials should be able to restrict what is being said on social media platforms, elsewhere, if they're trying to forward their own political agenda versus trying to, keep Americans safe from misinformation, their health safe, like during a pandemic. And I want to ask you both, I'm just trying to really step back here. And I think about if I had heard that Vladimir Putin was directing a social media platform or a media company in Russia to not post certain things, I would immediately think that he's an evil monster. He's an authoritarian who doesn't respect the right to free speech in Russia at all. If Donald Trump did it, I personally would not trust what his motivation was. When President Biden and the Biden administration says that they're telling social media companies to stop putting out conspiracy theories, misinformation, lies about the pandemic, about the 2020 election, I immediately think that the motivation is probably good because I have an inherent trust. And it's not just parties. If when I covered George W. Bush, I would not have immediately thought that the Bush administration was doing something with evil intent. So it really comes down to trust. It just worries me because there's a slippery slope here. And like, if I see the Biden administration doing something like this, there's inherent trust. But I also know that there are so many Americans out there who don't trust the Biden administration. And I just want to acknowledge that there is a slippery slope here.
Well, and in this case, the Biden administration, you can trust them on the front end, but they proved untrustworthy, right? There was the COVID lab theory that I mentioned that they were trying to censor. There was also the Hunter Biden laptop story that they put a lot of pressure on the social media companies, told them that it was not just misinformation, but it was in fact foreign disinformation used to affect the election. That turned out to be false as well. And I think that there's a difference, David, and one that's easy to say and harder to implement in practice, but between the government getting to Hector, like what Mo was talking about. Mo was at the DNC. He was on campaigns. His powers to affect the press and media were of persuasion, right? Like, he could use his best arguments. He could yell at them. He could call them. All of those things I think nobody has a problem with. It's when there's a stick or a carrot attached that we start getting really nervous. So for instance, at one point, Joe Biden went out and said the social media companies were, quote, killing people. I actually don't have a problem with that. It came up several times during the oral argument at the Supreme Court. That to me is actually pretty normal bully pulpit stuff. And Mo will appreciate that the two justices that were sort of most shrugging during this whole thing were Brett Kavanaugh and Elena Kagan, two people who served in senior government roles and were like, I think I did that.
Yeah, I may have written that line. Yeah.
Right? It was actually really funny every time they were asking questions because they were like, well, I don't really, or why are we here? But where it got concerning for me, and the record, by the way, is tens of thousands of pages long, and I do not want to tell listeners that I've read every single page. I have not. But there were several examples where there were at least intimations of using the authority of the White House. You know, for instance, that they would support legislation in the House and push their allies in the House to support legislation and write legislation and pass legislation that could hurt these companies, to use their regulatory powers to look into, you know, boy, it'd be a real shame if, you know, it turned out we dug a little deeper and found you'd violated some other random law. It's the power of government that you're threatening someone with. That's no longer persuasion then. And that's the line that the Supreme Court's going to have to find, because I don't think any of us have a problem with governments trying to persuade whether you trust them or not. It's the coercion part, and it's the using the power of government to threaten someone. That's where you, I think, are nervous about Putin. And that's where, frankly, you shouldn't have to trust your government. You just shouldn't have to. And when it comes to speech and First Amendment stuff, I don't trust any government. And I think I'm like the most pro-institution person here. But even when they don't mean to be wrong, they're wrong. Their own biases creep in, whether it's the Hunter Biden laptop story or the COVID story or plenty of stuff during the Trump administration. The government should not have the power to shut down speech except through that persuasion. And I will say, like at the Department of Justice one time, I think it's worth mentioning this story, the Associated Press had gotten a leak that there was going to be an announcement that we were declining to bring charges against a police-involved shooting. And we were trying to get federal law enforcement on the ground to ensure that the reaction was, you know, peaceful, mm-hmm. that people wouldn't get killed. And if the Associated Press went too soon, I was genuinely concerned that there could be lives lost, you know, or violence, who knows, until we got those officers on the ground. It is the only time that I can remember during my job saying, hey, you know, here's my argument. And I think there's a real security concern here for people and real people on the ground who aren't going to get to be part of this conversation between you and I.
Sure.
How are we going to work that out? I think that's really reasonable. And I think that you've got to find a way in whatever rule the Supreme Court's going to come up with, or that we here think about, that takes into account sort of national security concerns, security concerns,
yeah.
that are going to be the exclusive provenance of the government, but without, hey, you know, if you don't do what we want, we're going to pass legislation that punishes you for not doing it.
Yeah.
And it's going to be hard to draw that line.
Yeah, you didn't tell the Associated Press that the Justice Department would lash out at them in some way. It was just like, you need to understand
Absolutely.
The risk here and please
And by the
understand
way, we compromised, right? Like, they went to the story sooner. We made sure that they got the story first, but we also made sure that we had people there.
You know, there are people on the left who believe that that the government went too far in going after Julian Assange, right? Going after Edward Snowden. I'm not one of those people. I actually believe that those people created a huge national security risk for the United States. And so you're right, Sarah, that the court is going to have to, this is always going to be complicated. It's always going to be tricky. You know, I believe that there should be a very real national security consideration taken into account on some of this stuff. I would argue that looking back 4 years ago, that pushing back on vaccine misinformation, disinformation, masking misinformation, disinformation was very much seen as a national security issue at the time, in real time. And so it's always going to be complicated. It's always going to be tricky. And while I do err on more on the side of free speech, I think that I'm with you that let's use persuasion. Let's even use heavy-handed persuasion at times. Let's butt heads at times. but use of government, the government arsenal, so to speak, to try to get this maybe a bit too far, and figuring out how to maintain national security in that event is where it's, I think, the trickiest, where the line is the blurriest.
Well, and I'll just add before we move on. I mean, one reason this is such new territory is because it's social media. It can be anyone posting things, and you know, Sarah, if you're inside the Department of Justice, you're not going to be having that kind of back and forth conversation with someone who is just posting something. It's not like it's a news organization that you can, you know, sort of have that back and forth with. And that's why the Supreme Court is dealing with something that is relatively new, because the conversation with social media companies telling them to stop putting up posts that people have created is different than having a conversation with like a managing editor about the dangers of the timing of when they report something. And that's what makes this very new territory. All right. We're going to take a quick break and be back in a moment to talk about another issue of trust in our democracy. And that's, who do we trust to run our elections? You're listening to Left, Right, and Center. Okay, we're back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. Sarah Isger is here. She's senior editor at The Dispatch. Moa Lathy is here. He's executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. I want to return to our 50 states project that we've been doing all this election year. We're looking at local stories in every state to see what we can learn about our national political conversation, sort of covering politics from the ground up. And this week, Virginia lawmakers have been trying to change how the state's top election official is chosen. Instead of being appointed by the sitting governor, the job would need approval from a bipartisan election commission. And the hope here is to make the job of running an election apolitical, not politicized, to make sure whoever the governor is at the moment can't exert pressure over the person running elections. And this story in Virginia raises so many bigger questions. I mean, we've already talked about, you know, on the show today, you know, where our government should be drawing the line when it comes to our allies like Israel and getting involved in other foreign governments' democratic process. We've talked about our constitutional rights and right to free speech. But what about our election process? I mean, who should be in charge when it comes to ensuring that our elections are free and fair? I don't think this is something we thought about as much before 2020, but after so much effort went into disrupting the process that year, finding an answer to this question seems like it could be as important as ever. And we see this coming up in states far beyond Virginia. You know, this question of, do we need people to step in and take elections out of the hands of the people running them right now because it's become too partisan? Or looking at the other side of this, does that open up a whole can of worms in itself, trying to mess with how our elections are run and have a conversation about who should be in charge, because opening up that conversation seems like a dangerous path as well. So let either of you jump in. I'm just wondering, is this a good conversation to be having, or is it dangerous to open this door because it could send a message to voters like that you can't trust your elections right now, so we're trying to figure out ways to help you trust your elections?
Anyone who's listened to the show before knows that my institute at Georgetown does polling on the issue of polarization. We want to track voter attitudes towards polarization in politics. And in our latest poll, which just came out this week, we asked folks if they think that the 2024 election will be conducted fairly. A full third of the population says they are not at all certain, that they do not believe at all that this election will be conducted fairly.
Wow, that's a lot.
And honestly, a full 60% of people are either don't think it's going to be fair or think only a little bit that it's going to be fair. There is not high confidence in the election system right now. And so, yeah, I think that this is an important conversation for us to be having. If we're going to talk about how do we ensure trust in elections, it begins with who's conducting them. And after the 2020 election, we saw a bunch of election deniers running for Secretary of State in states across the country. Democrats went in hardcore to block them, and for the most part were successful. But I don't think that was actually the right strategy, because most elections and the way election laws and the way election rules are interpreted and administrated happen at a much more local level. And so we're seeing lots of little brush fires pop up all over the country dealing with this. You talked about Virginia,
right,
where what the state Democrats were trying to do in the legislature was actually force a supermajority on the state board of elections to either hire or fire, right? Believing that if you had a supermajority, that would take politics out of it. Politics actually prevented that from going through in the Senate.
Right.
In Georgia, you have a Republican state Senate stripping powers away from the elected Secretary of State, taking him off of the State Board of Elections and empowering the legislature to give greater oversight and investigatory powers over the sitting Secretary of State, who happens to be a Republican, who happens to be Brad Raffensperger, who famously pushed back on Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the election results in Georgia. State after state after state, we're seeing little brush fires like this pop up. And I think we're going to see that even be more so the case as we get closer to 24, as we come out of 24. And I don't think we fully understand the impact that can have on election administration around the country. We are seeing people leave the business of election administration, longtime volunteers who have been working the polls for 30, 40 years are leaving because of the pressure they've been feeling since 2020. And these are the fights that are stepping into that void. I do worry a little bit about the impact that that could have on our confidence in the system moving forward.
Yeah, I worry about confidence too. I mean, given that we see the conversation happening and your poll, I mean, a third of people don't think that the 2024 election is to be trusted, or necessarily to be trusted. I mean, that's alarming.
There's actually this really interesting book by Lawrence Lessig and Matthew Seligman, two lawyer law professors, called How to Steal a Presidential Election, that has come out just in the last year.
Wow.
And, you know, their purpose, I think, was to flag all of these problems with our system. I think I took something slightly different away from reading the book, which was, you can play whack-a-mole with the system as much as you want, but like for the example that Mo just gave, oh no, Georgia's trying to strip the Secretary of State of power, and that's Brad Raffensperger, who I like. Well, okay, but what if they were trying to strip the Secretary of State of power and it was some MAGA person who you didn't trust? Then you'd be like, aha, now this is helping democracy. And so like one of the chapters in their book is about rogue governors, right? The idea that it's actually the governor who's going to be the problem. Then another chapter's on, oh, it's the state legislature that's the problem. Another one's on the vice president is the problem. And here's what I took away from this book. If there is someone in a position of power who's going to try to overturn a U.S. election, we've got a real problem. We shouldn't put people in power like that, because our system is not made very well for bad actors. Now, I also actually, I think theirs was meant to be pretty doom and gloom, but I also took away from this that one bad actor alone really isn't going to be able to do much. It's going to have to be kind of bad actors throughout the process. And so I hear Mo's concern, and his concern, I think, to me, is that someone's reason, their motivation for wanting to change who's deciding things in their state is something that he's concerned about. I hear you. But remember, who's decided elections has changed a whole lot. I mean, back at the founding, state legislatures simply got to pick who the electors were and who they were going to support. You didn't even have to have a popular vote in your state. So think how far we've come in some ways.
But can I?
And we've amended the Electoral Count Reform Act. And yes, we're always going to be fixing the problem that happened last time. It's going to be really hard, I think, to anticipate the next set of problems. But
and who the next bad actor might be. I mean,
and
how do you know?
And who the next bad actor will be. That's exactly right.
But,
well, I just want to, I'm going to take the last word and just say that, Sarah, when you said that no single bad actor can change an election, I want to believe that. What I think is possible is that in our electoral college system, where a presidential election is incredibly tight. There could be one bad actor at the state level who has the potential to change an election. But what will likely happen is it will end up in the Supreme Court deciding the election. That's the most likely outcome if there are bad actors who do something
again.
Exactly. I mean, that is the very possible.
Well, outcome. This is where the Electoral Count Reform Act actually does help. We've really solidified the process by which slate of electors, it has to be signed by the governor. Two houses of Congress would have to override that. We don't need to get into all of the details of it now, but it has gone a long way to being a backstop against the single bad actor version, David, that you have, although nothing's foolproof. I think it is worth people considering what, at least sitting here right now, is a very likely scenario that Joe Biden loses the popular vote but wins the electoral college, and that Donald Trump wins the popular vote by a healthy margin, and exactly what that would look like across the country.
Well, we've seen what something like that can look like, yeah.
I go back to that poll. When 60% of the country has rapidly moved towards having little to no faith in the election system, it shows the power of a few bad actors and what a few bad actors can do to toxify our politics. And that's what really scares me and concerns
me. So we are working our way through all 50 states. And I just want to say, if you have a suggestion from your state for a story that fits into our project, a story that might teach us something about our larger national political conversation, share it with us. You can go to the Left, Right, and Center webpage at kcrw.com. That is kcrw.com. Go to Left, Right, and Center. Go to the Get in Touch tab and leave your story there. Okay, we are going to move to our Left, Right, and Center rants and raves. Sarah Isger, you, go for it.
Sure. I've got a rave today. I just finished two books that I think are super fun. I love when experts in their field write a book for the rest of us to just give us a taste of what their sort of careers and worlds are like. So one is called How Not to Be Wrong, The Power of Mathematical Thinking, in which just by page like 30, he's already proven to you that 0.99999 actually equals one. That's going to blow your mind. And the other book is Fluke by Brian Kloss. It's about chaos theory largely, but in the end, he's going to convince you that there's no such thing as free will.
Those sound way more fun than How to Steal a Presidential Election.
Yeah. I've been doing a lot of reading lately, and like you can tell what my reading for fun is and what my reading for absolute, like my vegetable reading versus my dessert reading.
Yeah. Mo?
We saw fascinating, and I say that in quotes, primary election in the state of Ohio this week, where three competitive Republican candidates vying for the GOP nomination to take on Senator Sherrod Brown. And not surprisingly, the MAGA-backed, Trump-backed candidate Bernie Moreno won. Since then, Moreno's been on quite the media tour, hitting Fox News and I think maybe Newsmax and back to Fox News as part of his new general election strategy, and where he is saying that moderate Republicans shouldn't vote for him. This is an increasing trend that we are seeing, as opposed to bringing people in after a hard-fought primary, reaching out to your opponent's supporters to bring them into your tent. The message continues to be, if you weren't with me before, get the hell out. I don't want you now. That is not a winning political strategy, and it is even worse as a governing strategy. I guess I'm just lamenting the days when we actually told people we wanted their votes, not to leave us alone.
All right. Well, I am going to rant about the IRS for not leaving us alone. It is March Madness time. I'm sure a lot of people are filling out their brackets, office brackets, family brackets, and maybe betting some money. According to Michelle Singletary, who is one of my favorite personal finance columnists, she writes for The Washington Post, estimated $2.7 billion in legal sports betting is going to take place for the men's and women's March Madness tournaments. But never forget that gambling winning is taxable income. The IRS, Michelle Singletary reminds us, requires the reporting of gambling winnings on IRS form W-2G. Now, there are some rules about the amount of net earnings. And like if it's 300 times the wager, that means that you do have to report. Seems really complicated, as everything is with the IRS. But just remember, if you're winning lots of money, watch out. They're coming to get you. That's all the time we have. Mo and Sarah, thank you as always. Left, Right, and Center is produced by an amazing team. It's produced by Mark K. Green. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show's recorded and mixed by Phil Richards. Todd M. Simon composed our show's theme music. And Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media. We are distributed by PRX. And that's a wrap. I'm David Green. Thanks for being here, and come back next week. We'll have more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.